Record. All right, back on the Arborwood Administrative Appeal 215 on November 19th, 2024. Mr. Telgen is still in the rebuttal direct of Mr. Lubisher, so we'll continue with that. Go ahead, Mr. Telgen.
I don't see either of them here.
Oh, okay. Let's give them a second there then. Okay. Oh, there we go. Okay, perfect. Yeah, I've already said we're just ready to proceed, Mr. Telgen, so go ahead. And Mr. Telgen, you're muted still, so.
Oh, I apologize.
There's
My screen suddenly shifted and I didn't know what was going on for a second. I'm back on now. Thank you.
Okay, great.
So Mr. Lubisher, I'll pull my screen up again. So my next question, you know, the COVID data was presented as contradicting, our theory or your theory, Mr. Rosine's theory and Dr. Cook's theory about how water gets into the wetland, that sort of, subsurface flow and the interflow is the dominant mechanism for water to enter the wetland. To discuss that, should we use this exhibit or should we move on to the next one with the flow diagrams?
Well, it might be worth making just one point before we move to the flow diagrams to reinforce the difference in permeabilities between these the units, and that if we look at say water getting into HA2, there are two pathways. One is, well, aside from direct precipitation, would be interflow zone, and in the interflow zone, lateral flow.
Mm-hmm.
And the other would be what amounts to a lateral flow from the well water bearing zone. And if we take the most conservative estimates for maximum flow from the groundwater, we have at least a factor of 10 difference in permeability between those two pathways. It could well, and because there are silt layers, I would actually expect it to be much greater, you know, probably more on the order of 100 times harder. And to that, we note the head difference is very small that's pushing these water. So based on permeability, you know, we'd have to say that, you know, likelihood of the groundwater being most important is just 1/10 or 1/100. That's
Am
why
I...
I've...
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, that's why in the next drawing, I sized the arrows as I did.
And just to summarize, I've drawn two more arrows here. One is showing the water going through this deeper geologic unit towards HA2. One is going through the alluvium colluvium.
Right.
Is that
so
right?
you should make the lower one much shorter.
Right.
And then qualitatively, the upper layers, you know, they've been loosened by weathering and bioturbation. Whereas the deeper layers, you know, have silt, some silt layer, thin silt layers in them, and that's all been glacially compacted. So
mm-hmm.
there's a substantial difference in the qualitative ability of these units to move water.
I see. Very good. Let's move on to the next exhibit.
Please.
And here we have a similar diagram that you have prepared. Can you tell me about this one?
This is the same drawing we've been looking at, except it's got flow arrows on it. So you'll notice I've got a set of light blue arrows indicating direct precipitation up and down over the site. And then at the upper right, we have a couple large arrows indicating runoff and interflow, and one diagonal arrow next to that showing some absorption, and a small arrow downward showing infiltration at the 120. And those same arrows in the interflow zone are shown all the way across. What's different here is the arrow under HA2.
Yes, this
This
one.
is bidirectional. Okay. This is where the precipitation-driven inputs are supporting the groundwater, as well as the groundwater at times supporting the wetland. So that is an essential conclusion of having walked through all these hydrographs and hydrostratigraphy about how the system works. I think based on the relative permeabilities, especially the small heads and the silt areas, that the dominant mechanism is still the inputs from precipitation, and their expression is runoff and interflow.
What about the applicant's position that the deeper source of hydrology is more important because it provides, I guess, more year-round hydrology to wetland P2?
I believe I recall two things that Mr. Koger said about that. One I talked about at the beginning, where he said it provided year-round water to the wetland. And the other, he said that it supported the wetland during the dry season. And I think what we've shown here in looking at the reversal of the hydrographs is that it's not the groundwater does not provide the year-round support, but that it could sub you know it could sub also help with the dry season support, sure, as well as the sponge effect of recessional outwash and the other loose layers up top. I find that a reasonable interpretation of the data we have in hand.
And but then if shallow subsurface flow, if the interflow were a dominant source, why don't we see more water in HA1?
Well, HA1, let's pop up, if we can, B17 and the HA1 log.
There it is.
Okay. So on the left, you notice that the top 0 to 1 feet, that's the topsoil alluvium colluvium. If you can,
The
that's the
top
tops that, yeah,
foot,
just
this right here.
treat them together. So that's our potential interflow zone. Underneath that, we have this silty fine sand, glacially compacted. Okay, that is where the screen is in that pre-Vashon silty sand, and you can see that in the well construction log to the far right, on the actual diagram. The
Wait, I'm sorry, I thought you were pointing out the non the pre-Vashon,
no no
non-glacial.
no well I've already yeah we moving beyond that. Just highlight the screen area.
Oh, the screen area, yes, right here.
Yeah. So the fact that it's non-responsive is due, I think, to two parts. One is the very top part of it is that bentonite clay seal. And like I said, that expands and, you know, it can bubble out of the ground. It can also expand downward because it's a highly expansive clay. Is basically separating the screen from measuring anything in the interflow zone. The screen is below the interflow zone, and it's in a, you know, glacial compacted silty sand. So I think it's just not an effective installation at this point because of the thinness of the interflow zone.
Right. So another way of saying, if I can go up to the top of this diagram, we've talked about the connection between EB1 and HA2, right? But if someone were interested in finding out if shallow subsurface flow were flowing into the wetland, say at a point at HA1, the way they did their well at that location is not the way you would do it if you were trying to find that out.
Well, you would probably supplement it with some other points. We know that the alluvium colluvium is much thicker in 103, 102. So it might, that area might still be loading up with water and kind of to push itself over into HA1 over time.
So can you summarize your conclusions for us and explain whether you think what Mr. Koger presented is actually inconsistent with your theory about how wetland P2 is recharged?
Sure. So first of all, the seepage does not undercut our model. It augments it. The actual productivity and timing of the seepage flows, aren't completely known. We don't have the year's worth of data and sufficient monitoring, but based on the permeability values and the low heads, I think the seepage is going to be small. It's not going to be unimportant, but it's going to be small. And that the dominant impacts, like we saw in the hydrographs, those blips in the HA2 and HA3, those are showing a significant impact, almost a foot of water. Showing up in the well points at that point. So it's a little more dramatic on the surface side than on the seepage side. The fact that we saw that reversal of hydrographs, that establishes that the wetland recharges the groundwater as well as is able to be pull some from times, so it's a bi-directional, and that's what you'd expect. I mean, wetlands are well known for recharging aquifers. So that's my take.
Very good. So then let's move on to Taylor Morrison's proposed, sorry, their proposed, I guess, I'm not sure what to call it, like redesign with exhibit B14. I'm gonna
Okay.
take off my, I forgot to take this off from earlier. So, what do you make of this new design?
It won't work to move water laterally. If you actually build it as it's drawn here, it'll silt up and nothing flat.
And walk me through that. Why do you say that?
Well, there's, if for example, if you place rock on existing soil and compact it, it's just going to drive the rock into the soil, and any subsequent water movement through that layer is going to mobilize the silts both above and below, and it's just going to clog it up. I mean,
And are
this
you
is
referring
a
to this 12-inch deep three draining material that
and the
they show
six
here?
inch it, read both of them.
Then the 6-inch.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's, I mean, this is kind of like the old time problem you see with older septic fields, where they just threw rock around their pipe and or styrofoam pellets, and over time the water flow from pipe coming out, but from precipitation going down through the surface just can. Move silt. It's kind of a micro hydro remodeling of the subsurface structure, if you would. that when you get water moving, it mobilizes the finer particles. You could consider it a subsurface erosion on a micro scale, and it's going to be moving silt in there. And you have to take great care to avoid that happening.
Okay. Do you have any more to say on this, or should we move on to the buffer averaging?
Yeah, the only other thing I could say, this is the third design, Mr. Examiner. It's never been through the review process. And it's not, I can't regard this as a serious design at this point. Unsigned, unstamped, not even a title block on it. No.
Very good. When we started this appeal, I began asking Mr. Heacock about the buffer averaging plan. And we had a lot of discussion about P2, of course, but we spoke specifically about the buffer gives and the buffer takes. And we talked about the drainage leading down to wetland P2, right? Leading from Hillbend down to P2, that all of this fill material is going to cut across. And I just want to emphasize again, I asked him if water was going to be coming into P2 from the two buffer give areas in here. And then yesterday, I think we had some testimony from Ms. Koski that she thought that we were claiming water was going into wetland P2 from, I think it was EP5 and 6, which were sort of headed in those directions. So I guess I'm just wondering, again, is water coming into P2 from the two blue areas, the two buffer give areas?
Yeah, definitely not. Let's see how best to show that. Can we go back to the catchment drawing? Can we show that again?
Yeah.
Can I just clarify? I'm sorry, Mr. Telegin. I think you described something as Ms. Koski testified. I haven't testified, so can you clarify what you're talking about?
No. I apologize. I'll pull it up here. Just one second.
I think that was either Ms. Bartlett or Decker, but
Yeah, no.
no,
It was
no,
yes.
not
It
that
was.
one. No,
Oh, I know. I'm just responding to Ms. Koski. Yesterday, Ms. Koski was asking, was I believe challenging Dr. Cook, and if you recall, there was an objection because Ms. Koski was asking questions implying that it was appellant's position that water was coming into wetland P2 from the points EP6 and EP5. But going back to the swales.
Yeah, can you show the drawing where I? Yeah, there we go.
Right.
Okay. So, Mr. Examiner, you see the P2 wetland and you see how the catchment edges are pretty close to P2 on the west side. Okay. So, those buffer gives area 3 and 4 that Mr. Telegin was just describing fall outside that area. So, all the precipitation driven inputs aren't going to get to P2. And
Right.
that was
The
in, I explained that in the appeal that if you want to hydrologically, excuse me, if you want to mitigate for hydrologic impacts of filling, damming the swale, those area 3s and 4s don't help.
Right. And then we've talked a lot about wetland P2 over the course of the hearing. Well, actually, sorry. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about wetland P2 over the course of the hearing. We've got new data and new designs about how Taylor Morrison now plans to protect the wetland. What about the other areas that will be impacted by fill material in the buffers?
Everything we have said about hydrologic impacts applies to these other areas. You take a look at L3 at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's within the swale that feeds L3, the area for so-called temporary impact. And so that's going to have a direct impact on hydrology there. And if we slide up to wetland 12, that is also true. That temporary impact, almost all of that falls within the catchment for wetland 12. And then up at the top, you just screened, you know, that's that very deep, 20-foot deep fill. That also falls within the buffer of L2, and it's going to, you know, going to do all the, you know, have all those adverse impacts. It's going to speed runoff because of an increased slope, initially very smooth. It's going to prevent any kind of absorption or infiltration into the inner flow zone, the upper layers, or into any deeper infiltration. What are the other ones we had? So it's
also the bridge crossings in wetland C6.
Yeah, they're not shown as temporary impacts, but those are all that fill, you know, and again, that goes, I think that's over 20 feet deep in order to get the road up high enough. That's all in the buffers for wetland C6, and that has not even been acknowledged. It certainly hasn't been mitigated.
So when the CABR decision was issued, we didn't have all this new hydrological data or conceptual flow paths or redesigns. In your opinion, was the CABR then based on sufficient information to determine that all of these impacts will in fact be temporary from a hydrological point of view?
You're asking me whether, say that again.
Was the CABR based on sufficient information to determine then if all these areas were in fact going to be only temporary impacts?
Yeah, it seems to me the CABR dodged the remand instructions pretty much entirely. Attorney Liao wrote a letter that turned examiner's words on its head and said, therefore, the examiner is including all this grading temporary impact. And it is not something we need to look at. I mean, her logic was completely wrong. And then Ms. Decker proposed what I call relatively impermeable fill as a meaningful pathway. And I think that's been thoroughly rejected. So, you know, if the applicant had, you know, really taken the remand to heart and looked at what we had given them, we would have had a very different, we probably wouldn't be here now. It just wasn't, CABR just wasn't, remand wasn't seriously addressed, in my opinion.
And so when you filed this appeal, it was the CABR, and then there was the document cited in the CABR, the DECA report, the supplemental CAO report from Ms. Bartlett.
Supplemental wetland report, yes.
Yeah. What remedy or remedies were you thinking of at that time?
Well, at that time, I was not thinking of specific remedies, but I was conscious that the appellants are kind of caught in a quandary here. We're being told in the remand that you know, these important stormwater impacts will get addressed during the SDAP, but give us our permit on the CABR. But then, you know, if we've appealed the SDAP, the county can come back and say, hey, we've already addressed critical areas impacts. That has no standing at an SDAP permit stage. So the question is, you know, is, you know, what are appropriate remedies? I don't think that's a particularly simple question. But I think we need to recognize the context in which we are requesting remedies of remand and conditions. And, you know, on a very foundational basis, you know, this whole thing started because Ms. Bartlett and Mr. Heacock made incorrect statements, shall I call it, about complying with the maximum 50% buffer reduction. And Ms. Bartlett is doing that again for the Arborwood Phase 2, which is on appeal, and SDAP on appeal. And we've seen the applicant seek to overturn their own testimonies. Mr. Wright and Ms. Bartlett were trying to reverse their official wetland categorizations. And then last week, Mr. Koger was rejecting Ms. Decker's permeable fill theory. And in terms of the hydrologic movement of water, you know, it started out with Ms. Decker's theory that the wetlands were fed by water from the till, and which was rejected. And then Attorney Liao was at questioning me about, well, isn't it coming from the Vashon Advanced Outwash? And of course, you know, that hasn't been seen on the site. And now Mr. Koger's testimony appears to being spun as all the water is coming from the groundwater. And, you know, I'm not sure he would agree with that. I don't think his testimony supported it. So we're in a situation now, 16 months down the road, and applicant is only now beginning to recognize there's hydrology issues that need to be addressed and mitigated on this site. So I'm suggesting that we need perhaps, well, certainly substantial, perhaps unusual remedies to move things beyond the slow movement we've seen on the applicant side. But very importantly, I think we have a reasonable case that DCD has, that there's an institutional failure to regulate properly. Okay. And I think that's something that should be taken into serious consideration. And it's probably worth noting what had happened if we had not appealed, right? The P2 swale would have already been stripped and filled with compacted fill. And the inputs of water to wetland P2 would have been seriously disrupted, and we'd probably be on the start to eroding a channel through it. So I think the remedies need to require effective performance, you know, up and down the line, from design to construction to monitoring and to guaranteeing maintenance at these sites. So I would suggest a remand is required because the applicants didn't really address their remand questions. We certainly haven't seen anything from the wetland reports that considered anything but replanting. In other words, there was no consideration for water quality or hydrology that is required by the code. I think a remand is also due because this third design continues not to minimize the impacts, and we offered a suggestion that would further minimize it, you know, short of building a full bridge over the swale. And so I think we're in a position where neither the remand design or this latest B14 design meet the minimization requirement of mitigation sequencing. And I was of the understanding that this new design would be subject to that full review. I think we also do a remand so that the wetland reports fulfill the requirements of 707.10 and 707.15 in the code, particularly with regard to the hydrology and the hydrologic structures, et cetera, as well as looking at the temporary impacts. I think there's a particular quirk that should be addressed, which is that a wetland specialist doesn't really fall into the category of an expert on hydrology and hydrologic structures. And in that extent, in that perspective, the wetland specialist is being put in an unfair situation. They're being asked to do something that should be being done by a licensed hydrologist or engineer. So that should be part of the remedies. We've already made the point that we thought that all this new information should have been submitted earlier, and we still submit, or I still submit, that it should go back on remand so that the county has an opportunity to review it. Though there's another quirk in that, which a wrinkle, as you were, that Mr. Heacock has testified that he lacks the special expertise and has to defer to applicants' reports. If that's the case, well, for one, you know, any citation or any allowance granted by agency deference isn't due because they're not actually exercising any special expertise. But they do have the opportunity to bring in, you know, a third party expert, you know, somebody like Dr. Rosine or Dr. Massman mentioned earlier, that have experience in hydrology and in stormwater. So I think the remedy is going to have to tweak the process here. This confusion between CABR and SDAP, you know, how do we get past that? And this is an opportunity by using remand and conditions that the process can move forward.
And you've heard the conditions that have been suggested by Dr. Rosine and Dr. Cook. Do you have any conditions to add to those?
I think that developing the conditions is going to require more work. I basically agree with most of what he says. There are some other things that I would add. In particular, this is somewhat at P2, this is a somewhat atypical design. It's not trivial, especially the part to infiltrate water from the dispersion trench into the interflow zone. And I think that a special review is reasonably required by that. We also have to have elements of monitoring and maintenance. The applicant or the homeowners association or the county in the future have got to be able to go to these trenches and monitor their operation. So that'll probably include some piezometers and things like that, maybe checking for silt through the cleanouts, but that needs to be part of the picture. We also need to ensure that those responsible parties are going to accept, you know, maintenance and monitoring in perpetuity. You know, first few years, may not be such a problem, but the county, I think, is going to have to sign off on, yeah, we think this is reasonable, and we are going to take responsibility for ensuring that this bypass structure continues to work in the future. I don't know. Okay.
That's okay.
And I would certainly agree with using pipes rather than trying to infiltrate water from the collector side to the dispersion side. It would be much more efficient.
Very good. So I'm about to end your rebuttal testimony, Mr. Lubisher. Is there anything else you want to say before we close?
Well, I think we need it. I think it's warranted to make a decision that these temporary impacts are permanent in nature, that they have to be mitigated. There are different ways to do that, but I think that has to be recognized. And I say the same for the utility corridor, because it allows future use that will be unmitigated. So I think that is an obvious buffer take. And the crossings, there was a lot of attention paid to the chapter 300 in the CAO, and the construction of a habitat, a wildlife corridor underneath. And there's been no attention paid at all to the takes of the wetland buffer and the adverse impacts there. And I think that needs to be included as a condition. Lastly, yes, one last thing has to do with this construction setback. I started out my testimony, not today, but earlier, showing the cross-section at the L2 wetland. Maybe we pop that up again. And I made the point that this earthwork is a unitary construction. It was described as being lateral support for the roads and buildings. it's a fiction that you can take part of that and say, oh, this is a temporary impact that we can just replant. It is part and parcel of the whole construction. And the idea of a buffer boundary, I mean, that is embedded in the critical area ordinance and in the definitions of a buffer, are that you're not building stuff in the boundary. And that's exactly what is happening here. Granted, it is not a road or a house, but it is impervious surface. And as far as the intent of the critical area goes, this completely goes against it. So I think these incursions into the buffer need to be recognized for what they are.
Very good. Thank you. I have no further questions for Mr. Lubisher.
Okay, Ms. Koski, cross.
Yes, Mr. Lubisher. I understand your testimony. I understand that you don't like the county's process for the CABR in this case. You don't like how this process has played out. The issue here on this remand was whether fill placed in the buffers will allow the hydrology to mimic pre-development conditions, which here would mean allowing the surface water and interflow at the road to continue to hydrate the wetland P2 to the same extent it does now or close to it, right? Which, based on the data you were talking about, I mean, the interflow, it appears to be a seasonal source of hydrology. So we need to mimic that with the fill that's being placed at the road. Do you agree with Dr. Rosine and Cook that with the 5 to 15% fine content and stormwater design changes that will happen when that becomes a final process, which I understand you want it to be sooner than later, but the process comes later. If the stormwater design plans take into account the recommendations and the ideas that have been presented here at this hearing, And if the mitigation, monitoring, and contingency plans that are already required as part of the CABR are all put into place together, do you agree that that's sufficient to allow the fill to mimic pre-development hydrology?
Wow, that was quite a question. Let me disagree with your first sentence. The remand issue is not just about P2. It included all the temporary impacts, the utility corridor and the crossings. And I think that Dr. Cook's testimony in particular, as well as mine and Dr. Rosine's, established long-term and permanent and or permanent impacts of the fill. Now,
so
your second part of your...
Do you think that it can be rectified or no?
I think you're trying to address the second part of her question, so I would object.
Yeah, I'm going to have to...
Let Mr. Lubisher finish answering, and then Ms. Koski, you can follow up.
Yeah. So the second part of your question was kind of overwhelming. You were asking whether I agreed with Ms. Decker's permeable fill proposal, right?
15, yep, 5 to 15.
And you were asking about a bypass design for P2 in specific. Is that right?
Well, just generally infrastructure design. I'm trying to get at whether, look, this isn't just like a isolated thing, but if these things working together address your concerns about hydrology impacts of the fill in this development. So that would include changing it to 5 to 15%. It would include stormwater design plans, and it also include all the requirements that are already in the CABR of mitigation, monitoring, and contingency plans.
Mitigation, monitoring, and what?
And the contingency plan in case the revegetation doesn't go as planned.
Okay. As opposed to the fill contingency plan?
Yes. I'm just asking if these measures that were discussed during this hearing are sufficient to address your concerns, or if there's something else that you think is needed.
Well, let's remember, first of all, at P2, right?
Well, I'm just asking about the fill generally. And I'm not necessarily limiting it to P2. That's been the focus in this hearing, but we're talking about the fill in the Arborwood development, which is all going to be designed to the same specifications. So if you could just tell me whether the issues that you're hoping to address through stormwater design combined with the other factors that we just discussed.
Mm-hmm. So the fill specification is not the 5 to 15. You're talking about the 15 to 40?
Nope, talking about the 5 to 15 that's been recommended that Ms. Decker testified will be incorporated into what goes in here.
So that was only for P2, for the P2 fill?
No, that's for all the fill.
Oh, that was, I, no, how are you going to do that? That's completely, you know, for the soils on the site, you're not going to be able to do that. You'd have to be importing huge amounts of fill if you wanted to do that everywhere on site.
So what would you recommend? What are you saying? Like I'm having a hard time finding your fix. Like what is it?
Okay. Mr. Examiner, I am going to ask for, I just need 5 minutes. I've had it. My hearing aid battery died, so I'm having a little trouble hearing. Okay. You can wait for me to fix that or take a break as you wish.
Okay. We'll give you, until 3:10.
Thank you.
3:10.